Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
A Motorsport Podcast Network production.
Hey everyone, great to have you along for The Drive. I'm Aaron Noonan. This is the V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Castrol. And if you've just finished listening to part one of my chat with Paul Radisich, you're going to really enjoy part two. There's tales of V8 supercars in Australia. The days with Dick Johnson Racing, and yes, that win in the wet at Queensland Raceway. And yes, that Bathurst that got away in 1999. Briggs Motorsport, 888 Race Engineering, Team Kiwi Racing, HSV Dealer Team. We cover it all and how he managed to fight back from those two nasty crashes at Bathurst with Team Kiwi in 2006 and the HSV Dealer Team in 2008. The crash that stopped his professional career. So buckle up, we're going to rip into it right here, right now. Let's pick up the discussion with the two-time FIA Touring Car World Cup winner, Paul Radisich. So, Peugeot, no go. Two-year deal is over after 1 year. So suddenly, okay, I need a gig. I need a drive. I need to do something here. So at the very same time, John Bow leaves the Dick Johnson Shell team in V8 Supercars here in Australia. Was that the only place you could have gone for 99, or was there other opportunities that you put to the side to come and do the Aussie V8 thing?
Well, I threw the net out to as many people as I knew, and I was very close to getting the Williams drive, and had many meetings with Frank. But at the end of the day, they decided they had to have a French driver, for the obvious reason. So that didn't work. But at the same time, I had Wayne Caddick gave me a call, and he said, "Look, would you consider coming down and doing a year with us?" And at that time, I sort of felt that I needed a change. I needed a break. You know, super tourers were great fun to race, but not a lot of fun to – they're not fun. They're not – you know, when you go testing, it becomes a bit monotonous. So I saw this as a great opportunity to get back in the sun and closer to home and experience at that stage the new cars. So that's how that came about. So we thought, okay, we'll come down, do a year, let things settle down in Europe. If there's any opportunities going forward, then we'll look at it, you know, we'll look at it then. So down we come.
And down you came to a new chapter and one that our listeners will remember fondly. You spent so many years in V8s, but obviously that first part of it was with DJR. Straight away, I remember that there was such a response to your driving. You'd just done all those years of British touring cars where it was, you know, short, sharp races. You got to get in, you got to get it done. If you got to use a bumper or a fender to get in among it, you do it. Do you reckon you ruffled some feathers and brought a bit of that BTCC style to V8s that maybe they weren't quite used to here so often?
Yeah, I think so. I think I was probably, probably too aggressive because, you know, I'd spent 5 years, literally, like you say, Aaron, you got to you got to make hay while that first couple of corners come up. Otherwise, you just get stuck there. And I think that I definitely train myself to go racing that way. So, looking back now, yeah, I think I could have probably come at it at a slightly different angle, not quite so full on, and, looked at finishing more races rather than trying to lead them into the first corner. Probably not quite so that bad, but you know what I mean. So, but then saying that, I think people enjoyed my style, and I gave everything that I could at the time to everything. I was fully committed, and I did the I felt I did the best that I could do.
There's some really memorable moments from your time with Dick's team in that Falcon era. And when we put the call out to questions to our listeners in the last few weeks, there's two themes that pop up very regularly. One is Bathurst 99, feeding the horses, all that stuff,
yeah.
And 2001 at Queensland, in the gravel, winning the race, in the wet, with the Yahoos running around, throwing their T-shirts around, who we still get asked, who are those people? We want to meet them. We've never found them. But isn't it amazing how those things are the things that stick out in the minds of so many people for so many years?
Yeah, indeed. And, the Bathurst one's a heartbreaking one. Of course, the other one we won. But, to lead, look, the AU was, how do you put it, piece of rubbish, really. the aero was designed, I think they designed the back for the car to go backwards, because the scoop at the front, all that did was remove dirt. It was, it could be a work for the Ministry of Works for that thing, just as a little mini digger. So it had so many problems. And I'll just back up a bit. I remember with the AU couldn't get the thing to just aerodynamically was horrible, let alone everything else with the car. And I remember driving the EL at Queensland, the street race around there, and the car was so well balanced, and you could do anything. We went on and won those races, and you could just do anything with it. So I learnt a lot from the EL, which transferred over to the AU when we went for that, which happened, I think, the next race, I think, must have been Bathurst. So we did learn a lot and try to set the car up in a similar format to how that old EL was, other than the aero. And look, we had a great horsepower at Bathurst, and we were able to use it. And that's the only thing that catapulted us, right to the front for that event anyway. But, to lead, I think strategy wasn't brilliant for the day. We're always coming from behind. And we had to work the car fairly hard to get back into the front. And then with, 15 laps to go, I passed a slow car over McPhillamy. And I didn't feel it, but it must have just touched the wheel or something happened. It pulled the valve stem out of the wheel, and boom, that's it, all over. If we had we'd come out and clear. I couldn't get into the pit and filled the thing up with dirt, but I mean, at that stage, the race was over. But when they cleared it out and went back out, we only did another 5 laps, I think, and the engine expired. So the chances are, it was not my day. It's not my race to win. I think if it had to keep going, if that didn't happen, probably did another 5 laps and sat on the side of the track anyway. But I had a good chance to see the horse, pat the horse, and make a new friend.
You got to find the positives in these things. That's it's definitely a race that lives on.
Yeah, look, and at that time, Aaron, it was disappointing, by of course, but it was like, okay, well, next year, but next year never came.
No, it's that race that gets everyone, and it's if you don't win it, it's the stories of all the ones that came close that will live on for many, many years. And I wanted to cover off something with you here too, mate, because I remember it's probably about 5 or 6 years ago, we did a piece for the Supercars website, And you told me then that from that one-year deal that you first had with DJR in V8s in that 99 year, that there was half a sniff for you to go to Stone Brothers to drive the Pertec car the next year, but you ended up not taking that or not pushing it far enough. In hindsight, given where Stone Brothers went in those years after, would that have been a better call maybe? Do you regret that one from your V8 journey?
Look, I didn't have a choice. I pushed it as far as I could go because I did want to go with the Stones. At that particular time, my contract was with Ford Australia. So, and they made it very clear to me that they wanted me to stay with Dick Johnson. And look, I enjoyed my time with Dick. There's no issues there, I guess, because I'd worked with Ross and Jimmy in the past. You know, I knew what they were well and truly capable of. So I pushed that extremely hard to try and convince Ford to put me there and Marcus at DJR, but. It didn't work out that way. And at the end of the day, you know, it's like it sort of come down to, well, I guess you might have to leave if you don't go there. So I made it very clear that and you know, at that stage I was happy to go back to Dick's anyway.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
That ended up being a 4-year stay to the end of 02. The 01's probably the standout year as far as years go, the Queensland win that everyone remembers, but you were the man in Perth at Wanneroo. You had a great run there and won there and contended for the championship up until the very last round or so. But that Queensland one sticks in people's memory banks, that 500 winning in the dirt down at turn one there. I don't think people remember clearly enough, and I was there that day, that weather, I've never, and I don't like to use superlatives of the best ever and the biggest ever and the most this, but I do not remember another race event where the weather came so quickly out of nowhere on what seemed like an okay day, and it just turned in an instant and absolutely tipped down. It was nasty.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? But, I mean, I was in the car, so it was getting darker and darker, and it wasn't sort of much talk about it. It wasn't that much talk that it was going to rain, let alone, you know, torrential like it did. You know, I think, when, as you say, when it came, it just come from nowhere. Just literally, it was like a, you know, like a lake, wasn't it, you know? It's funny, when it's going on, it's like, oh my God, it's pouring with rain, and I'm on slick tires, and your brain's going, you still got to keep going fast, you know. And it's the next thing, I'm going down the front straight backwards, and thank God they make the right decision to call it back a lap. That's all I can say. But hey, we deserve to win the race, Stephen and I, Johnson. You know, he drove well, I drove well, we led pretty much all day anyway, so it was, you know, would have been very disappointing to lose it just because it, you know, the weather had changed to monsoon. We're talking about that car, you know, Stephen, you know how tall Stephen is. What is he, 6'5"?
6'4", 6'5". Yeah,
he's a big four, right? Yep. So, you know, I'm 5'7" on a good day. And so we had to make a seat that literally was in the boot, and would go forward far enough to get me in it. So, but of course, it's one thing going forward, but also at the same time, I needed to go up. So the boys made an ingenious seat. It had the ramp on it, went like that. It was not vertical, but, you know, whatever that is. 60-degree.
Diagonally up. Yeah.
And when it was back, it was, you know, sitting right back. And then when you pulled this lever, it was like a rocket going off. And it was all spring and hydraulic. And then you pull this lever and you go, woof, and push the whole seat forward. So I'd jump in and I'd right at the back, pull this thing, and it just shoved me right the way forward. But in practice, we're going along and somehow it hadn't quite clicked in. So I'm going down the back straight and all of a sudden the seat lets go and I'm sitting in Stephen's position, you know, and I can't reach the wheel, can't reach the pedals. So luckily it didn't happen in the race. The things you're probably not allowed to do those things anymore, to alter the seat to that sort of characteristic so we could so we could both drive it.
Ramp seating is definitely a dangerous thing when it goes wrong. Good when it works, not so good when it doesn't work. You became famously known, a name that stuck with you through time is the Rat, and it came in that V8 Shell DJR era. I think there's a few different people who claim the credit for it. I think there's a few journos, friends of ours, David Siegel, the team PR guy, who really started that. And at the time, I'm guessing it wasn't a nickname that you were thrilled with, but to your credit, you embraced it. I think there was merchandise, there was a logo developed. It was something that you went with. But do you remember who started that? Who can we give official credit to for that nickname?
I think Gova had quite a bit to do with it. I think between Gova and Siegel.
And we should point out that's Paul Gova, the journalist who's been on the pod before.
Yeah.
Been around a very long time, PG.
Yeah.
I know he's claimed credit, but does he have to share the trophy with someone? Maybe David Siegel, the DJR team PR guy at the time.
Yeah, look, I think those two are having a quiet beer together, and I think it's like, well, everyone has trouble pronouncing Radisic or Radisic. Why don't we, between those two guys, and then they took it to Shell, and I think Shell said, hey, that sounds quite interesting. We better run it past Paul and see what he thinks. But it didn't bother me at all. I thought, well, it's a bit of a giggle and whatever. But when we started to use it and everyone picked it up and their merchandise appeared, it just ramped up, and there was awards for merchandise with the Rat Attack, and so I thought it was cool. Everyone in Australia needs a nickname, and the Rat, I think the Rat was it I don't know, suited me.
Went with it, just went with
just
it.
Just went with it, yeah.
Mate, what the DJR chapter finished at the end of 2002, and by then the team was really uncompetitive in that last year of 2002. Where did the wheels start to fall off for the team, for the results, for your relationship with DJ? It all sort of ended not as great as it started.
Yeah, it was a shame. It just, you know, when these things happen, they grow their own postcode, you know, and everyone gets disgruntled and fingers get pointed, and you know, I just felt it was time to move on. And I've battled through bad results and issues and worked our way through these things, so you know, I think it was just time to draw a line in the sand and get back to another challenge. I don't think there was one. There's a lot of reliability issues going on, if I remember at the time. And money was tight. And I remember Dick talking to me about certain things, and you know, one of them was how tough everyone was doing and lack of funding at that particular time. And as we know, motorsport, lack of funding means lack of new parts, and things like unreliability start creeping in. And I think, you know, thinking back to that era, that was a big a big part of it.
The next chapter became Briggs Motorsport, which became 888. Why Briggs? What attracted you to going there rather than perhaps somewhere else?
I think there was a lot of things. John was he had big plans. He had a great crew of people around him. He had the ingredients, and it was a small team. And I think at that particular time, I just felt that something I could contribute to make it better. And that was purely it, really. And he was in Queensland, and just the ethos and the way that he went about things, I could see that there was real, there was real potential there.
And clearly there were some people in the UK that saw a potential and a bit of opportunity there to later that year buy that team. It became 888 by the time, I think it was just before Sandown and the 500 as well there. So had you been able to help the 888 thing get over the line and help make that happen, given you knew Ian Harrison and Roland Dane and those guys from your time in Britain?
Well, the short answer is yeah. I met when I was doing some racing in the UK, and I met up with Roland. He invited me to come and see him. We had a little chat about the racing in Australia and what was currently going on. He was at that particular point, and then he came to Australia and we met again. He was very keen to try and at that stage buy the Holden Racing team. That was, that probably sums Roland up fairly well, really, looking at where you want to go, I thought that was probably a little bit optimistic, and as it turned out, I'm not too sure if he did try and poach that subject, but we'll take it that he did, and it failed. And so he came back, and we had another chat, and he said, "Well, what about the Briggs team? Would that be available if we were thinking of coming into supercars?" And I said, "Look, I'm pretty sure John would be interested in selling." And as it turned out, he did. And so Roland put the package together, and I was involved with a lot of that. I was also involved a lot with the sponsorship to make sure Better Electrical stayed with the team, and I was there in day one and helped them get established.
Could you have foreseen the level that they've become the dominators in terms of not just on track but off track as well, or does none of that surprise you given what you already knew?
There's a lot of things I don't know, and that was probably one of them. No, you could never have that vision to look, Roland, even then, very organized, very disciplined, very motivated, and he knew the direction that he needed to go. But, there's one thing having all that, and there's another thing doing it, which he's been able, was able to do over a period of time. So, but at that stage, it was all about getting established, and John Hitson and even the boys, Mark Dutton, still there today. They were there from John's day, and Jeremy as well, come back. So, I knew he had some great kids around him and men now, and he was able to nurture and get the best out of them, and then bringing people like Ludo into the fold just increased it. And it's one thing about Roland is that he whatever it takes, he'll pay the money to do that, to get the right people around him, and that's part of his success.
How bittersweet was it, mate, to get that first 888 podium last round, Eastern Creek 2004, but be heading out the door as you were, lifting that trophy? I mean, so great to achieve their first podium, but at the same time knowing that that was it, that was your last run with that team?
Yeah, it was, you know, that whole chapter. I mean, I probably, you know, when you look back and think, I left myself too open for, I really thought that, you know, I mean, my goals were to be involved with that team to get what I needed out of V8 supercars and a very, you know, very selfish position. And I could see that the team over a period of time would potentially give me that. But, you know, I when my contract came up, it expired, Roland said, look, we're not going to continue on. I can understand why he wanted, you know, new faces, fresh faces in a team that he was building up. And I guess my face was still involved with the Briggs side of it, even though I was cemented in the mortar there a little bit. He wanted to have a clean sheet of paper. So, you know, trying to say, well, look, why don't I stay on as a endurance driver? Or I was disappointed. I was hurt. I was a lot of things. So I just felt it was best just to you know, move on.
And the next chapter there became a swap to Holden's, but you got to stay in Queensland, though, because although it was Team Kiwi, it was at Paul Morris Motorsports. Mm. So you didn't have to travel far. You could stay in the sunshine. It worked out okay.
Yeah. Well, the whole TKR thing, that's a whole different chapter. But, and look, you know, with David John come along and said, look, would you drive for Team Kiwi? And I said, no. And then he sort of persisted and he said, well, what's the problem? I said, well, who's going to run the car? And so he went away and put a deal together with Paul Morris and I was very, very happy with that, you know, and Paul Sepranich was the engineer. So the ingredients were all with them. Paul was producing some great cars and had the setup to do it. So I said, okay, I'll be happy to sign now and we did for a little while anyway.
Yeah, it's one of those chapters that ended a couple of years later with the Ford thing. But it all ground to a halt, and there's probably another whole podcast in the history of Team Kiwi, but there's probably a couple of things that stand out there, and everyone, and we will talk about it, the crash at Bathurst, but I think a lot of people probably look in that Team Kiwi era for you and think about that big Bathurst crash, which we'll cover in a sec, but I think a lot of people forget Shanghai, China, the one-off round in 2005. I guess you're the carryover podium finisher from China because we never went back. V8 supercars never returned there.
No, I know. And I didn't get to stand on the podium either.
Oh, that's right. Yes, that's right.
From what I remember, the car was, you know, was really good around there, and the Morris program got stronger and stronger and stronger, and then we got to a point where the bills were not getting paid, and then it all sort of started to fall apart from there. But Shanghai was probably the peak of our powers in that particular car with that program. So yeah, to finish third on the podium there was really something. And, you know, I guess being a Kiwi car, it sort of resonated with the fans in China because, I don't know, they just, you know, it seemed it was very, a very popular third place anyway.
And am I right in remembering that the heat actually got to you and you're in a bit of a struggle there for that podium?
I had food poisoning and from the day before, and I was sort of starting to come right, but yeah, just dehydrated and just got a little bit too much. So be careful what you eat.
Hard to drive a race car if you're not feeling the best, that's for sure.
Done that a few times.
Yes. Oh, what's the worst time you've been sick in a race car?
Well, Adelaide was probably because I the first Adelaide, and not really been fully geared up for such a demanding race, and the water, we ran out of water during the race, and in the pit stop they couldn't get any water into it, so I did half the race with no water. And just dehydrated, and then I remember going past the pit timer, and I'm looking at the dash, and I'm going to myself, that lap time just doesn't look right. Why is it so slow? And I managed to get back around and pulled into the pit, and when I pulled in the pit, I just collapsed. So luckily, I had the mindfulness and still just had enough there to be able to get the car back to the pit. But you may remember those cars were so, at the end of the day, they were very fumey, no ventilation, and they're a hot day, and I'd run out of water. I mean, I should have demanded that I shouldn't have gone out until, we had water in the drink container. But hey, you, when you're racing, you want to stop for the least amount of time as possible, right?
Once a racer, always a racer. Yeah. I think a lot of lessons were learnt out of that first Adelaide 500 taught a lot of teams lessons about exhausts and where to run them, and ventilation and windows and air cooling and all sorts of bits. There were a lot of things that weren't known before that first Adelaide 500, which is the 25th anniversary of that first running this year. So it's scary how time flies.
It is, isn't it? And look, a lot has been learned, which has been great because, you know, the floor get hot, the pedals would get, you'd finish a race with blisters. Remember, you got a gear stick, changing with a mensch, so you got blisters all through your sort of left hand, your blisters on your feet from the temperature. You've been soaking in a huge amount of fumes from the cars you've been following, let alone your own. It was not a good. So, the whole category has learned a lot out of people like us doing the guinea pig work for them.
that's one way to put it too.
Let alone Bathurst. I reckon I've single-handedly sorted out all the bad spots of Bathurst for everybody.
We shouldn't laugh because it's true though. And if we look at that, there were two accidents, 06 with Team Kiwi and 2 years later with the HSV dealer team with the Walkinshaw operation. But they did, if there was something good to come out of what were terrible injuries to you and the last one stopped you from racing professionally further, that there were lessons learnt, that those areas of the circuit were modified in the following years and those accidents can't occur again in the way that they unfolded to you.
Yeah. And that, which is good because I don't want anybody to go through that, hitting earth, bank, tyre filled, banks is just, that era should be well and truly gone, and it should have gone before I, experienced it. But as you say, it's a good part about it is that any time that anybody says, well, a car can't go there, you can put money on it that it can.
And in that case, if we look at 2006 at the chase, the exit, probably the last thing anyone thought could happen there, but when you're on the outside of a couple of other cars, a small touch, you're off the road and head on into a wall. That car stopped so suddenly, it flipped on its side. Tell our listeners about the injuries and just take us inside that, because it had been such a rough lead up to Bathurst that year. We'd lost Peter Brock a year earlier. Mark Porter, fellow Kiwi, had his crash on Friday. It was already a difficult weekend, and then that happens to you. Take me inside that Team Kiwi car of what you remember and what unfolded, because I can't even imagine not just the accident, but stuck in there with all those injuries in the aftermath.
Well, it sort of started because I was running around the outside of a slower car, and he moved across on me, and it just looked, once again, just a slight touch, but it broke the steering arm. And it just shot the car because you're under acceleration out of the chase. And it's not that faster. It's not at that quicker area on the track. You know, it's not that quick, but under full load, it just shot it straight off and it went straight into the earth bank. And when the car hit it, it spun it over on its side. And the force, like, I just remember the force of the initial, because the inertia of it stopping instantly was what did the damage, of course. I couldn't feel anything with my legs or anything, which was probably kind of good at the time. But I remember hanging upside down there, and there's some fluid running down my neck, right down the back of my neck. And I'm thinking, the first thing I thought of was fuel. And so my initial, because I was conscious through the whole thing, so my initial thought was, any minute this is going to blow up and I'm going to be burnt here. So that took away any feeling of any other pain that I may have had. And then it wasn't until they sort of, it just seemed like forever to get me out of it. When they did get me out, then obviously the pain of the legs and the feet and you know, everything else that went with it, started to kick in. So, I don't know. When you break things, it's the pain doesn't appear until a little bit later on. So it was a matter of getting there, out to the helicopter, and flowing off to the hospital.
And what was broken? What was injured? Ankles, legs? Remind me of because it basically put you out of racing for quite some time.
Yeah, it did. It was, look, it shattered all my feet. I've got posts in my right leg, but my feet was the biggest. It just smashed all the bones in my feet, and then worked its way up and broke my chest bone, and ribs, a few fingers and things like that. So, the biggest issue was when we got back home, in hospital, they said, well, you've got some choices here. You can either, we can put you in a full body cast, and you got to lie down, you're stuck there for 3 months, or we don't put you in a body cast and you just go to sleep for 3 months. And that's it. So it was decided not to have a body cast. So we just checked out of life for 3 months, really, while things healed up. And then after 3 months, it was time to try and to learn how to walk again. And luckily, we had a pool at home. So I got people coming every day to carry me into the pool. And I'd spend all day in the swimming pool just trying to walk around the pool. And then within a month, I could walk around the pool, and then I could get out of there and start walking on land. So it was a process. And I remember we had a manual Jeep, and as everything started working again, I started driving the Jeep because I could use the clutch. Initially, I couldn't use the clutch to put any weight into it, then after a little while I could, you know, build my leg up to use a clutch in the car, and then I can't remember exactly when, but we got back up again, jumped back in one of the cars for, I think it was Barbara Gallo, I think it was my first race back with Team Kiwi Racing. So it was a long process, and one that, to be honest, I've never really talked to anyone. You're probably the first one, other than my wife, that I've told.
It's something you wouldn't wish your worst enemy to go through, that sort of a scenario. But was there ever a thought after that first one that the world might try to be telling me something here with motorsport, or was it fully eyes forward on get repaired, get healthy, get back in a car next year?
Yeah, pretty much was. Aaron, it wasn't, well, shall I No, I still wanted to give back. I don't know if that was pride or stupidity or just that's what I know. So, and I think, I had David on the other end going, hey, how are things, I've got this and we got that. And, everybody was very positive about trying to get back. So I had no thoughts about, I wanted to get back. I didn't want to end on that note. I wanted to keep going, which I should have stopped.
Yeah. I was going to say, by the time you came back the next year, the badge had changed because Team Kiwi had moved to Ford with a car out of Ford Performance Racing over in Campbellfield in Melbourne.
Yeah.
So you got back, but by the time you weren't going back to a Paul Morris car, you were going to a Falcon. But then that deal unraveled in the middle of the year, and I can only presume it was to do with money.
It was, yeah. And look, part of the rehabilitation was the fact that we were going to go over to Ford Performance Racing. So that was a big motivator for me, to one, to be back in a Ford, and two, and with a top team. So, we're talking to them, talking to Tim, all that stuff. So you reminded me now why we wanted to carry on. So when that program happened, it was like, hey, we're back into something again, and there's a chance of being competitive. So you can't blame me for not trying to walk away, I guess. And you're right. At the end of the day, the finances fell apart, and that was the end of it. And by that stage, Ford Performance had their co-drivers locked in, and there was sort of nowhere really at that point to go. So I'd sort of resigned myself that, well, we'll just let it go for the season and see what happens. And then we had a call out of the blue from Rob, from HSV, Rob Crawford, and said, would you like to come and join us for the endurance races?
Which at the time that team was the reigning champion team. Rick Kelly was the supercars champ. Garth Tander won the championship that year. So you go again from this scenario of out of a gig, the money stopped, to the championship winning team rings up, which just tells me that straight away that there's great love and respect for what you had and what you were doing and what you could bring to that team. Because you might remember this or you might not, but they had signed a young bloke called David Reynolds to co-drive that year. And then he was kind of, when your availability popped up, I think they went, well, the experience of a Kiwi bloke versus the zero Bathurst starts of a young guy out of Carrera Cup, they put him with the PWR team and you were in with the Toll team. But the thing that I really am interested in asking you about, and when we did a call out for questions on Instagram, there was a guy from Queensland called Craig who wrote a comment, and you shared a car with him at the Toll HSV dealer team at Bathurst in that year. Craig Baird's the guy I'm talking of. He said on a post that you were the toughest bloke that he ever raced and that you were enemies for years and then you became lifelong friends, a guy who he truly respects. He posted that. He actually went out of his way to post that. And there's no but and there's no punchline or anything after that. So tell me the Bairdo-Radisich story. You end up driving together at Bathurst all these years later, but where was the rivalry? Where was the enemy element formed and where did the friendship come? Tell me about the Paul and Craig story, as it were.
Well, we were bitter enemies from, you got to remember Formula Atlantic when so Craig was just starting off and I was already a veteran in Atlantic when Craig started. So he was a new guy, the new guy on the block. And so our rivalry, our competitive rivalry started back then. It took him a year to work out how to get the best out of the cars, and then he'd come back as a real strong competitor. So we were fighting on the track, and quite frankly, we anybody could beat me other than Craig. I was okay with. And, you know, we just – it sort of went then with touring cars, and I went to Britain and then came back and did some races back here, and him and I were battling it out. You know, it was war on the track and off the track, you know, just – it's just the way it was. We were just very competitive and competitive against each other. And then Craig took my, when I left Ford in Britain, Craig took my seat, in WSR. And there was, you know, I think from that point on, we started to see each other a little bit more, and we sort of patched things up with, you know, how we both sort of felt about each other. And then we went on to racing in New Zealand first, I think it was, with Gary Pedersen. Him and I teamed up and did that. And it's like all things. You know, we realized we had a few things in common, and we actually got on really well. And so more it turned then from there to being civil with each other and being more friends. And then we had the opportunity to race at Bathurst in the toll car, and you know, him and I we work well together. I mean, Craig's style of driving is very smooth, consistent, fast. You know, all the things going back that you hated, you enjoyed, and to watch him drive and then be alongside him was. It was just sort of top the cake, and you know, even today we keep in touch, and you know, our friendship is growing.
So from all enemy relationships and rivalries come lovely friends. Who if only it had taken you a few more years to get that all together, you two, but you got there in the end. You got there in the end.
Yeah. I guess it's very nice of Craig to say that. It's, you know, tough, I guess, on the track. You know, at the end of the day, you know, I do whatever it takes to stay in front, and I'd like to think that it was always reasonably fair. I think I was having my time again now. I'd probably be black flagged every lap, but you know, that's what I do. You know, try and hold my position and keep what I've got rather than going backwards.
You're not here to handball the position. That is definitely not the case. It's not the job at hand. Hey, mate, you got back to drive with Toll. I think you finished runner-up at the Sandown 500 with Rick before you drove with Craig at Bathurst, and then you stayed on with Rick for the next year as a co-driver, and had a really good Phillip Island, which is where the 500 had moved to, and then Bathurst, I think it was the Saturday morning practice session and top of the mountain and the throttle jams on that car from my memory, and you're headlong into the wall at McPhillamy, just where the concrete wall wasn't protected by barriers. Of all the places to go in, it was the wrong place.
Yeah, it was the wrong place. Who would have thought things happen in pairs? I didn't believe that, you know, and up the top of McPhillamy, and I you know, you get one of those feeling. I come out just before we come up to McPhillamy, and you're hard on the throttle, and I remember having something doesn't quite feel right, which is, I've no reason. I have reason now to say that, but at the time, it's like, yeah, that's okay. And then when I got to the top of McPhillamy and lifted my foot off the throttle, because it's literally a moment, momentarily, just a quick lift and back down, the throttle stuck and it was wide open, and you know, it's, how do you, you know, people say, oh, why didn't you fight it? What if, you know, when you got a ton of car going straight ahead, you know, you, even to try and turn the engine off or do anything at that speed is just an impossibility. I remember going, I'm just going to, the car's going straight for the wall. I'll try and steer it to the right one to try and scrub some speed so I don't hit the far away wall. But you know, that's about the only thing I thought of at the time. But yeah, that was, you know, to go through what we did with the with the TKR accident, and then effectively 2 years later, two years later, be in the same position, being flown out of the track to, you know, go and basically break everything I broke in the first accident, I rebroke in the second. So it was a little hard to swallow that one, Aaron, I must admit.
Was that harder to swallow, mate, because it had been a mechanical drama? The Team Kiwi one was just a racing incident. It was no one's real fault. It was just a situation where the cars were on the track. But in that one, you know, if you'd made a mistake or cocked up, then you'd sort of put your hand up for it. But that was one out of your control.
Yeah, look, it was. Did it make it? Didn't help. And it probably would have helped if I had come back. And that's probably about it. But, you know, the brain capacity to absorb all that and to deal with it again, to be honest, I don't know how I really, you know, family and friends got me through. I don't know how I got through it, to be honest. And just day at a time.
The physical recovery is one thing, but I guess the, you know, as you alluded to there, the impact it has on your brain, on, you know, the effect it has on your family and your loved ones and the people who are close to you in your world. You've just done it and popped out the other side, and here you are back in it again. I mean, was it a harder physical recovery and mental? It was a bit of everything altogether, adding up to what was a really difficult return from that one.
Yeah, look, it was just I guess the realization that it had, that the end result, you were back in the same spot, you know, as you were 2 years ago, it's really hard to take in. I mean, at some point, I think I must have said to myself, "It's you just got to deal with it. Just deal with it," and we did. And you know, it was really hard. Patricia and the kids were young kids at that time, so you know, there's another whatever it was, 3-6 months of it just vanishes out of your life, trying to get, you know, rehab and all those things you got to do to get yourself back to health. But hey, we did it, got through it, and I didn't go back professional racing again. I figured I took the hint the second time, Aaron, and you know, move on and do something else. The annoying part is that the love of motorsport and the love of driving will never go away. So and every car I get into, I've done some endurance stuff and even the super tours. Whatever I do, I still find myself being very competitive at it, and I love it. You know, it's me. It's you can go back to the days of how it all started, which was, you know, every time I went past the pit lane and looked at my dad, I had a big grin on my face. You know, and that's how I feel even driving today. So I don't think that'll ever go away. And I've just got to be realistic that, you know, I'm not 25 anymore.
I know the feeling of that too. was it – so the decision to not continue racing professionally, was it your decision wholly, or was there a medical doctor's element in all of that, or purely you?
Look, I can't take another knock. If I take another knock, who knows what the outcome could be. So there's a fair bit of risk in that. But then that risk can be there anyway. It was my choice to say, okay, well, it may not be the way I wanted it to go to end, but that's the way it has.
And it's such a shame you don't get to, you know, make – it's a bit like footballers or cricketers who – you know, they get injured. They don't know when it's their last game. Their contract doesn't get renewed. Sport can give us these wonderful fairy tale endings, but then in yes. other cases they give you an ending that you don't see coming in the script. But the fact that you're here to tell the story is probably the winning element out of it all. But, I mean, it hasn't been the end of motorsport for you, mate. There's been so much more since then. There was some time with the NZ Super Tourers that is such a shame that that category had all sorts of dramas and couldn't get up and firing. We saw you back with the Super Black team that ironically ran out of Pro Drive, the old FPR, there for a time. So we didn't get rid of you there. You're still around doing lots of racing through that 2010 era and being connected in a lot of off-track roles.
Yeah, it was. And they were great things to be involved with. You know, Tony Lantino and the Super Black had a vision to try and, you know, help Kiwis to get into the main game and achieve that. It's like everything. Everybody wants to win, but, you know, sometimes it doesn't happen. Well, not sometimes. It doesn't happen overnight. So keeping everybody's enthusiasm and keeping reality in there is always a big gulf to try and to fill in. But, you know, Tony was, and we lost Tony, and that's part of the main reason that Super Black didn't continue. Is, you know, Tony passed 4 or 5 years ago. So otherwise, I think if he was around, that program would still be happening today.
Mm. Speaking of today, I know a lot of our fans are keen on knowing what you're up to. We talked earlier in the first part of our chat about business, but what is the business? What is the business of oil that keeps you busy these days in New Zealand?
Well, Egypt's Oil is we're the sole lubricant blender in New Zealand. So we, you know, if you think of Shell or Mobil, then we produce
or
oil.
Castrol. Got to say Castrol. They're a great sponsor of ours.
Yeah, they are. Castrol, they're a great brand. I hope they say that about me. But it's a brand that it started many years ago. I helped my dad establish this brand 40 years ago. And you know, he kept it running while I was away living my dream. And then when it was time for it to end, it was time to come home and pull the reins and understand the blending and the manufacturing and the selling of oil products. And that's what I've done for the last 10 years. So it's a great brand here in New Zealand. And it's, you know, as I say, it's been around. We've been around because it is second generation producing products for New Zealand and the islands in particular.
Any other guy, Paul, I would not have let her have a free plug for another oil sponsor on our Castrol sponsored podcast. But for you, we make exceptions because you're a special man. You're a special man. Hey, mate, you've been very giving of your time. Before you go, we've got our National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions. The National Motor Racing Museum is at Mount Panorama Bathurst. You might remember it at the bottom of Conrod Strait there. They've got some amazing old cars and bikes and memorabilia. Okay. If you're ever looking for some of that memorabilia on your shelves to find a home for a special exhibition in Australia, I know their number. I can hook you up. But this is our chance for the fans to ask some of their questions of you. Graham Swan's got one. We'll race through them fast. They won't hurt too much. There's a couple of curly ones. But Graham asks, is it true that in your Ford British Touring Car contract, you were promised a drive of an F1 car that was powered by a Ford engine?
No, false.
Duh. That could have made a great story. Sean LeBroy's question was, did you ever think about owning your own team at any stage?
Many times.
And?
And many times I didn't branch down that path. But it came up in many super tourers, V8 supercars. At some point, you know, and probably the 888 scenario probably got as close as I was ever going to get to being heavily involved in a supercar team.
Was there ever a chance that you might have become a part of the ownership group at 888? Just a question that popped into my head.
Well, the answer to that is yes.
And I take it from that's about as far as we're going to go with that one. So let's grab a few more questions here. There are some good ones here. Corey State asks a lot of food-based questions. I'm not sure where I am on this one, but is it okay, Paul, to put barbecue sauce on a sausage roll?
Yeah.
I'd go tomato as my first option, but barbecue is a good second option, I'd say. We explore the big issues here, mate. We explore the big issues.
So I don't eat sausage rolls, but I do it.
You'll take it on. You'll take on the challenge. Chris Rodriguez asked, who's the co-driver that you didn't get to but you would have loved to have driven with in the Bathurst 1000?
Well, I drove with Rickard Rydell. I drove with Craig Beard, Max Wilson, Stephen Johnson, Brad Jones. There'd be a lot.
I was going to say there's a few others there.
Who would have I liked? Well, I would have loved to have shared the drive with Peter Brock, because we did in New Zealand. It would have been, and if it wasn't for Andy Rouse, I would have. But then if it wasn't for Andy Rouse, I wouldn't have got a Ford contract in England. So I'll let Andy off for that.
No, fair play, fair play. Adam on Instagram, did you ever own a Radisich Telstar?
I own three of them.
Really?
Yeah. I've still got a brand new one, only done 400 kilometres, and I've got two others that were repmobiles in the day sitting in the garage.
For those who don't know, potentially some of our Aussie listeners don't know, what was the Radisich Ford Telstar?
Well, it was a derivative of the Ford Mondeo.
Mm.
And it was a Telstar, the four-door saloon. It had the V6 engine in it, 2.5 litre. But they had really bad suspension, and they were sort of, how do we put it? They were a nana car, and Ford couldn't sell them. So it was like, hey, here's an opportunity. How do we make something, that's not sell like hotcakes? So Ford did a special run, special wheels, didn't touch the engine because there's enough performance there, signature on the car and suspension. And it turned that car around to be something that was, if you get a chance, just Google Radisich Telstar and it'll come up. Beautiful looking car. Even if I say so myself.
Oh, you're talking it up like you sound like you're trying to sell one of them to me. Jeez, it's unbelievable.
Well, I've got three for sale, so you know.
No. Oh well, we'll go via Paul's Honest Car Sales, care of New Zealand.
The upside, Aaron, there was only, I think there was 3,000 built. So they were a limited run. They sold them all through the Ford dealership. They sold out of all those cars literally overnight. That's why they were going to just build 1,000, and they extended that to 3. So over a course of a couple of years. So, you know, it was, it's pretty cool to have your name on the side of a car.
Yeah, there's not many people who can claim that one, that's for sure. Mate, fantastic chat. Thank you for your time. Before we finish up, just one quick one too. We have a lot of young racers who listen to our podcasts and read our stories and follow the stuff that we do and hang off every word that guys like yourself say on pods like this. Lots of youngsters out there racing go-karts or grassroots motorsport. For someone who's been right to the top to become a world champion twice over and all the stuff that you've done around the world, what's your advice to the youngsters who might not be trying to get to Formula One or V8 supercars, but just want to enjoy motorsport and make something of it? But what have you learned across this journey of all this stuff we've discussed that you can maybe pass on to the next generation, or the things that you tell young drivers who seek you out for advice in New Zealand?
And you know, I think the key, Aaron, is you do have to chase your dreams. You do need to have a dream. You do need to focus on what that dream is. It might be completely different to what you set out to be, but you know, I think you've got to want to do things. You've got to chase hard, and it doesn't matter if you're doing it for fun or you want to be a professional racing driver. And it all really comes back to the want, is what we say, or the motivation to get up every day and keep chasing what you want to do. And you know, I always say the easy option is to give up. So don't take the easy option. And if you keep at it, you keep at it. And sometimes, you know, I mean, there's lots of young guys that I talk to and help, and you know, the question is everybody wants to get there yesterday, but it takes time, and you know, you've got to do the hard yards. And unfortunately for your listeners and your followers, you know, from New Zealand and Australia, it's hard yards to break out. And if anything, it's still hard, but it has got easier in the last 10 or 15 years. You know, the world's a smaller place. There's just more opportunities. And if you've got the talent, then get out there and prove that you've got the talent, because if you do have it, someone will spot it, someone will help you. And don't be afraid to ask, you know, what's the worst anybody can say?
Exactly.
And look, don't be put off by, you know, things like accidents and things like that. They do happen. They don't happen to everybody. You know, don't let those things put you off. You know, I had a couple of bad experiences, but saying that, you know, I also had a 30-year career in motorsport, and I'm just pleased that I had that. I've had that opportunity. I've had the opportunity to see, you know, be at the bottom, and the opportunity to be in the top, and you know, something I wouldn't change a thing.
Paul, yours is an amazing story. Thank you so much for giving so much of your time. Keep selling that oil.
You bet.
Over there in New Zealand, and we look forward to seeing you hopefully behind the wheel of a Mondeo Super Tourer somewhere around the world sometime soon.
It'll be something, Aaron, but something that I enjoy. And then, look, I will be at Goodwood this year. I'm going to go and race with my good friend Roger Wills at Goodwood for the revival in a Cyclone Mercury. So, because you can only drive cars that are in the 60s and 50s and things like that. So, just a great event. So I love going back there every couple of years. So I haven't entirely hung everything up yet, okay?
Keep pedaling, mate. We love it. It's been a great story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. We wish you all the best. We'll chat to you soon.
Pleasure, mate. Thank you.
Ah, what a ripper he is. A huge thanks again to Paul for taking the time to chat. We covered plenty of ground, but there's still so many things that I'd have loved to talk with him about, but it's so hard. I could talk for hours, but we all have things to do and places to be. But a big thank you to Paul. He's a Kiwi racing legend, and hopefully, sometime soon, there's a way for him to drive something in Australia. He's been doing a bit in New Zealand and the UK. How good would it be? Radisic, World Cup winning Mondeo, Australian racetrack. Maybe Bathurst? That'd be pretty cool, wouldn't it? I appreciate so much, too, the love that we get from our listeners, the V8 Sleuth faithful. And you can do your bit too to keep this podcast rolling. Now, Castrol are a huge part of what we do, but without them, you don't get this regular free podcast. So let them know on socials and when you choose your oil that you're listening, because we appreciate their support and your support as well. Right, keep the guest suggestions flowing and keep the questions coming too via the form on the v8sleuth.com.au website. And I'll have another edition of the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Castrol for you very soon.